Welcome to my podcast, where I share true stories of survival, overcoming obstacles, and failure. These stories will inspire and motivate you, as well as provide you valuable wisdom and lessons learned to help you face the challenges of life, and most importantly, keep you in the fight. Episode 49, Air Florida, Flight 90. This is an unbelievable story, and I don't want to take anything away from it, but we're really going to focus on the survivors and what happened in the water, and nothing about the airplane and things like that and what was going wrong. You can research everything on your own on that because there's a ton of information on that, but we're going to focus on the aftermath because there is heroism here. Sacrifice, and we're going to focus in on what is known as the unknown hero, the man in the water. So buckle up. This is a good one. Here we go. January 13th, 1982, Air Florida, Flight 90 was due to depart what is now known as Ronald Reagan National Airport, Washington National at the time, and about a 2.5 hour flight down to Tampa. And that route at the time was pretty regular, that day on the tarmac, it was blizzard, snowing like crazy. Visibility was really low. There was lots of delays. They were clearing the runway. Snow was just piling up, and Air Florida Flight 90 was at the gate. It had loaded all its passengers. There were 79 passengers and crew on board that day, and they had gone through their checklist to get the airplane ready for flight and de-ice the wings, done everything they were supposed to do to get ready. And the tarmac did open up, the runway was open, and the plane started to stack up. Well, it took quite some time to kind of get in the queue behind the other planes, and there was significant delay, so much delay that they heard later on the cockpit recorder that snow started to form on the wings. Again, there was so much delay. And the captain said, no, let's push forward. At the time, the captain could make that call. And hey, if we get out of queue, we're going to have to go back in the same situation. So he saw other planes taking off without any issue and didn't feel the need to go back around and get the wings de-iced. So they continue to wait, all the passengers on board, and everybody's been there. You're sitting on the plane like, gosh, when are we going to take off? This is taking forever. And it did take a long time. And in that time, snow did build up and ice reformed on the wings. Well, it was their turn to queue up and throttle up the engines. The tower gave them the green light. All right, let's go. So they powered up the engines. They started heading down the runway. The co-pilot was the first one to notice something was wrong. The instruments were reading something different than what they should read. The pilot did acknowledge that. They kept pressing forward and got about halfway down the runway. The readings were still off, but they reached the speed, liftoff speed. They pulled the nose up. And within a few seconds, the nose continued to rise up, and they didn't have enough power. The nose continued to climb up, and their instruments started to make all the noises that they were going to be in a stall, that they were approaching a stall. And that means you don't have enough power to continue to climb in the vertical attitude that the plane was climbing. So the pilot told the co-pilot, nose down, just climb a little bit. And he did do that. The plane didn't react fast enough, and they just didn't have enough power was the problem. They'd only traveled about a kilometer off of the runway, not very far at all. Just in front of them on this snowy, blustery day was the 14th Street Bridge. And at that time, at around 4 p.m., on that bridge was a total backup of cars that were stuck because of the snow and ice and the weather conditions that day. And the plane started to fall out of the sky right towards the 14th Street Bridge. And as the plane impacted the 14th Street Bridge on the tail section, it completely crushed four cars. I think it sheared off the top of one of the trucks, killing four people instantly. And the front of the plane fell into the icy Potomac River, broke through the ice, and immediately sunk to the bottom. The tail section flipped off the back of the bridge, fell into the Potomac River as well, broke through the ice. And that was the situation within seconds of taking off. The tower had lost visual contact, but also communications with the plane. They didn't know that it had just crashed into the 14th Street Bridge. But the people on the bridge calling 911. Obviously, this is a horrendous situation. We got a plane in the water. We got multiple casualties on the bridge. If you look up pictures of this of the bridge and the cars that were smashed, they were completely flattened. And so the police and rescue started to show up immediately. And what they noticed when they showed up is they had survivors, which is pretty unbelievable at the time, right? Who survives the jetliner crashes? Not many people. And that's why this story is so unbelievable to me as they started to dig into the backstory of it. Not only is it a plane crash, but it's in the middle of winter in an icy river and broken through the ice, and we have survivors. Well, a part of the back of the airplane had floated above the water, above the ice, and they could count six people clinging to that wreckage. And on the wreckage, there was Nikki Felch, Joe Stiley, Priscilla Tirado, Bert Hamilton, Kelly Duncan, and Arlen Williams were still apparently alive. And they're in freezing cold water. Life expectancy is very, very short. We've got to get them out of the water quickly. The rescue crews are lining up on the bridge, on the shoreline. There's actual video of this. If you want to go check that out after you hear the story, it's unbelievable. And so one of the issues they ran into immediately is they couldn't make it through the broken ice. The ice was so thick. There are inflatable boats. They couldn't walk out there because they would fall in, but they couldn't get their boats out there because there wasn't enough water to paddle through to get there. And they were just really struggling. The victims were holding onto the wreckage, and it was literally in the middle of the river. And it was just desperate. You have people and camera crews and rescue people and everybody. They're trying to deal with all the carnage on the bridge as well as trying to desperately save the people in the water. And at that time, they called up the rescue helicopter to get on station. And a pilot and co-pilot hopped in the helicopter, which wasn't equipped to bring anybody on board, but they grabbed what ropes they could and threw it in the helicopter and got on site as fast as they could. And so the survivors, Nikki, Joe, Priscilla, Bird, Kelly, and Arland, were in a horrendous situation. Not only did they survive the crash, they had multiple injuries. Bert Hamilton had I think he had recorded 60 different broken bones throughout his body, and his face and his arms and his legs. Priscilla Tirado was sitting with her infant daughter and her husband. They were going to start a new life in Florida. Well, it's just her now, her husband and daughter, and now they're at the bottom of the Potomac. Nikki Felch, Joe Stiley, Arlen Williams, they were just clinging to this wreckage and desperate, barely treading water. The helicopter shows up on station, and they're trying to assess, how do we help them? How do we quickly get this rope down to them? How are we going to get them from that wreckage to the shoreline? They dropped one rope. There was Bert Hamilton was just off the wreckage, treading water, struggling. They were able to get a rope to him, and they literally just dragged him with the helicopter and the rope to the shoreline. Got her, or excuse me, him over to the shoreline. They returned, and they noticed somebody waving their arm, and they sent down a rope, and the rope went into the gentleman, Arland Williams, who was waving his arm. He caught the rope, and he handed the rope to Nikki Durham, handed it to another person, and that person was able to hold on to the rope and get dragged out into the river. She lost grip. I think she had to grab the rope multiple times. And with all of her injuries, you can imagine getting dragged across the ice over to the side. Though they returned for another one of the survivors. Again, Arland Williams, who was waving his, had his hand up. They could see, hey, he's in a desperate situation. Let's try to get the rope to him. They now drop two ropes. One rope goes to Arland Williams. He again passes it. He passes the rope to one of the other victims. One of the other survivors. And they bring the next two survivors. I believe it was Joe Stiley and Priscilla Tirado. Joe was just holding on to Priscilla. She struggled. Lost grip halfway across. She's just struggling in the water. He was able to get drug over to the side, and she's blinded by all the jet fuel. In the video, you can see that she's just struggling. She happened to get on top of a piece of ice, but she can't see anything. She's gonna die. There was a gentleman on the shoreline that just couldn't watch this any longer. His name was Lenny Skutnik. He ripped off his clothes and just dove into the water to save her. Swam out there, grabbed her, brought her to the shore. They were able to save her. And again, they went back because there's now Nikki Felch is still there. They went back, and Arland Williams, with his hand up, they were able to get the rope right to Arland. He passes the rope to Nikki Felch. Again, refusing to be rescued and passing it to Nikki. And they are able to rescue Nikki. And all the time, of course, on the bridge, they're dealing with the fatalities that happened up there, the cars that were destroyed. There's tons of injuries. And on the shoreline, dealing with hypothermic survivors of this plane crash. And just chaos, and with the helicopter trying to save everybody. So the helicopter drops off Nikki Felch and has dropped off all five of the survivors and goes back. We got to go back. We must go back for Arland Williams as fast as we can. How much longer can he live? They fly the helicopter back to Arland, and they don't see him. Matter of fact, the wreckage had shifted and sunk, and Arland was lost. And they kept searching for a while, and it was apparent that he was gone. They weren't able to save the sixth survivor, who now was a fatality. And that's what was so unbelievable about this story is who is this? Who is this man who they later identified as Arland Williams? Who is this hero that would have the courage and the character to pass the rope over? And that's all that is going on. Everything that's happening. He was able to say, no, not me first, somebody else. You know, he saved those other people by passing the rope. He saved lives that day. And all through the news, they didn't know his identity right away, but his heroic actions were caught on camera, and they were unbelievable to everybody. And when they found out who it was, you know, it was just this unbelievable, you know, support for, you know, just lifting up Arland Williams as this, because they called him the unknown hero. They called him the man in the water who would pass the rope on and save others. And that's where we find the wisdom and the and pull out the character traits of this hero. And in researching this for this podcast, I found a speech by former President Ronald Reagan that he had given to the Citadel years after the crash about Arlen Williams and talking about how somebody has that character and be able to make those choices amidst all the chaos that's going on, amidst his own life and giving up his own life for somebody else. And I want to just kind of wrap up this with a part of his speech, which really blew me away, because it's everything we've been talking about in the podcast over and over about small choices. And I think Ronald Reagan absolutely summed up the character of Arlen Williams and how he was able to make a choice that day. And here it is. So President Reagan says, "And now we come to the heart of the matter, to the core lesson taught by the heroism of Arlen Williams on January 13, 1982. For you see, the character that takes command in moments of critical choices has already been determined. It has been determined by a thousand other choices made earlier in seemingly unimportant moments. It has been determined by all the little choices of years past, by all those times when the voices of your conscience was at war with the voice of temptation, whispering the lie that it really doesn't matter. It has been determined by all the day-to-day decisions made when life seemed easy and the crisis seemed far away. The decisions, piece by piece, bit by bit, developed habits of discipline or of laziness, habits of self-sacrifice or self-indulgence, habits of duty and honor and integrity, or dishonor and shame. Because when life does not, when life does get tough and the crisis is undeniably at hand, when we must in an instant look inward for strength of character to see us through the situation, we will find nothing inside ourselves that we have not already put there." I read that from President Reagan and it blew me away. That character to pass the rope, to save others above himself, it just didn't transform and it wasn't just there that moment. It is already done by all the choices he had made in the past, the day-to-day decisions of having discipline, self-sacrifice, and the habits throughout his life. And that's a testament to Arlen Williams. It's a lesson for us to make those choices when nobody's watching, those little insignificant decisions that is the right call. It's the right thing to do, because you never know when you're going to be called in a crisis and be able to make the right choice. So there you go. That was Air Florida Flight 90. You can look up all the details about what those pilots did wrong, how the plane came down, if you're into that sort of thing. But hope you enjoyed this. Stay tuned for the next one. See ya.